just assume the model and the agent itself is an insider threat and potentially malicious. And now you have to secure your environment with that as a threat model.
All that and more on Security Intelligence. Hello and welcome to Security Intelligence, IBM's weekly cybersecurity podcast, where our expert panelists turn the biggest industry news stories into practical takeaways you can use. I'm your host, Matt Kaczynski, and joining me today, Kimmy Farrington, security detection engineer making her podcast debut, Ian Malloy, department head security research, and Seth Glasgow, cyber range executive advisor. And here's what we're talking about today. Attackers are nibbling at the edge of the cloud. Ransomware gangs are living off the land. Cybersecurity's rusting edge. And someone finally cracked the Xbox One. But first, I want to talk to you all about promptware. In a paper entitled The Promptware Kill Chain, researchers Bruce Schneier, Oleg Brot, Elad Feldman, and Ben Nassi argue that current discussions of AI vulnerabilities focus too narrowly on prompt injections. Instead of treating these as the end-all be-all, they say, we should understand them as the first step in a seven-step kill chain they call promptware. Promptware, they say, offers a model for how attacks on AI LLMs really look, starting with that prompt injection initial access, and then moving through your classic stages of privilege escalation, recon, persistence, command and control, lateral movement, and action on objective. To start off, I want to ask you first here, Ian. What do you think? Do we focus a little too much on prompt injection at the exclusion of some of these other things? Or how do you feel about this promptware model? What's your take?
I definitely think we focus way too much on prompts as kind of the initial and only thing people focus on, especially when they talk about, oh, here's a prompt, how am I going to stop it, guardrails, how am I going to, you know, make a better model, things like that. And what they don't tend to realize is that the entire space of everything the model may touch is part of the attack surface. And so what I think they did that's kind of nice is they've kind of taken the standard kill chain, they realize, hey, this is just another technique or sub-technique. You know, prompt injections are a new tool. It's like a hammer. Where can I use it? And boom, here it is. And they've kind of demonstrated throughout the entire life cycle, here's where it applies. But really, the attack surface is quite extensive.
Kimmy, what about you? What do you think about this kind of promptware model in general here? I mean, do you think it offers some useful insights or what's your take?
I think from the layman's perspective, it definitely provides some insight into what the attack surface can look like. Yes, I think that up until this point, we have focused mostly on what is the initial prompt? How do I ask it to do something? And then further than that, when does the model pick up other instructions, right? We've started to hear about Copilot in your email can get silent instructions it added into it because somebody put a white-on-white text information in there that said, from here on out, do exactly what I said or whatever the prompt was, right? So there's a couple of the versions of prompt injections that people are kind of aware of, but this promptware discussion goes much deeper, I think, and really starts to highlight the fact that there are multiple pivot points that the attackers can jump into, and defenders are at a loss to try to block all those holes, you know.
Yeah, speaking of kind of defenders being at a loss, you know, Seth, I wanted to ask you, you know, what changes for us if we start to adopt this kind of model of understanding it as kind of promptware, right? Does anything change for us, or is it just the same old stuff with a different coat of paint? What's your thought?
It certainly should change. You know, even though we've taken this and applied it to the standard kind of kill chain with the research they've done, and the paper does a really good job of actually specifying, hey, when a lot of people say prompt injection, they actually mean these first 2 to 3 steps. But in reality, it's different, right? I think the exact paper quotes something around, you know, prompt injection may carry a jailbreak payload, but they are two conceptually distinct concepts. And I think something that we have to adapt here to is the absolute scale of this, right? The paper describes a couple of different ways that prompt injection first happens, either direct prompt injection, something we're familiar with, you know, the forget all previous instructions kind of thing, and then indirect prompt injection, right? Which is where they're able to seed documents, seed information that the model will consume, and then that is what compromises it. So in that indirect model, basically one compromise could scale fail indefinitely outside of the attacker control, which is what the paper lays out. And I think that's something we have to begin to understand is that we've always had worlds where attackers are able to amplify their efforts, right? Like phishing is the common example. I write one email, I send it to a million people, we see what comes back. In this model, they can do something very similar. I infect one model, I see where it can get. And then because the agent, or agent even aside, because the target here, the AI, the chatbot, is intelligent and has its own access, where normally a human would have needed to get in the loop, continue that reconnaissance, right? This can sort of happen very, very quickly and at a scale that previously we were unused to, right? Not possible previously.
Absolutely. And you know what? You mentioned agents there, and I don't know if you did it on purpose, but I do kind of want to ask you about that. You know, this paper talks largely just kind of about like your chatbot LLM, but do you think things change if it's an agent? Like what's different if we're using this against an agent? Any thoughts there?
I don't know if it's too different. I think what it could be is it could be potentially worse, right? If these agents can interact with each other, if I've taken this one on, then potentially I could have this agent replicate the flaw to another agent, right? Now, I'm sure there's a lot of specifics on ways to prevent that. And the paper does go into quite a good level of depth on the ways that you can actually try to prevent this, but there are varying efficacies, varying amounts of effort that have to go into that. But I think the agentic side, where we're expecting these agents to take input, trust the input, take an action, and then move on and keep processing, well, that's where the danger is, right? These instructions, by definition, look legitimate, which means they will flow into the rest of traffic, and these agents will action them and not necessarily know that anything was amiss, so to speak.
Absolutely. And I think that segs pretty nicely into kind of a roundtable question I want to pose to all of you, which is that, you know, the researchers write that because prompt injection cannot be fixed yet, and here's a direct quote from them, we need an in-depth defensive strategy that assumes initial access will occur and focuses on breaking the chain at subsequent steps. Ian, I want to start with you. I mean, do you think that that's the approach to take here? Just assume access is going to occur and we have to break it somewhere else? What's your thought?
It's by far the easiest. The way I usually tell people is just assume the model and the agent itself is an insider threat and potentially malicious. And now you have to secure your environment with that as a threat model. So basically, whatever it can do, you need to now be able to limit it. You need to be able to prevent it, its ability to propagate, to move laterally. You need to limit its ability to leverage any of the permissions and capabilities that it's been getting from the user or from the environment. All of this has to be considered as though it's completely just an inside malicious threat.
Yeah, I like that. It reminds me of something that Dave McGinnis said on the show a few weeks back, which is that like AI agents are basically the most helpful insider threats we've ever had, right? Like, I like that categorization of them as like you said, assume that they're already an insider threat and just make sure you lock down that access to appropriate levels and limit that kind of blast radius. Kimmy, how about you? Any thoughts on like, okay, if it's true that we need to assume breach, how do we approach securing these things? Any takes there?
It's going to be a huge challenge, mostly because the places where the instructions are incurring are not visible to your average defender's log. Right. So we're going to have to find new ways to log things so that we have access to the conversations. We're going to have to find new ways to log things so that we can see where it's picking up the prompt injections that it's getting from wherever it's picking them up. And so without being able to see the holes, you can't put plugs in them. Right. You can't defend yourself against what you don't know. So this is going to be a whole new learning experience for a lot of people. I think a big part of it is going to be locking down the AI agents, figuring a better way of doing identity access management with AI agents, right? If you can know that it was an agent doing it and you can know what kind of permissions that agent had and what sort of model that agent was built off of, then maybe you have a better chance of defending yourself against the potential misuse or abuse that that agent's credentials could allow it.
Absolutely. And that's, again, that ties into a theme, too, that we've seen on the show before, which is that, like, in many ways, agentic security is like it's an identity and access management problem, right? Like, it is about understanding who's doing what, who's accountable for it, what can these agents access? And there's a lot to untangle there. But if we approach it from that identity security lens, I think it starts to shed some light on things. Seth, to kind of take us home for this segment, you know, your thoughts on what do we do about securing these things based on what we've learned from this promptware kill chain? Any takes there?
Yeah, so I think it does come down a lot to the identity and access management. What these agents are, these chatbots, whatever they're doing, they are highly privileged accounts whose entire function is to go out and connect disparate sources of data, right? So we have to treat them just as privileged as anything else and have to strictly monitor that access. I think there's also something that we can learn, because if we look at this, and the paper has a good table that compares these different types of injection attacks, you know, all injection attacks at some level are basically a problem of separation, right? The instructions and something bad are too close to each other. The way that I can access the data and directly speak with it in an SQL query, for example, is the problem. So we can start to look to other injection attacks to try to figure out ways to block it off. But fundamentally, the agent itself is an identity that is being manipulated or socially engineered in a certain sense. And so we have to limit what it can do and accept that it probably will be engineered at some point. We will not be 100% in being able to prevent these things from happening. So telemetry around understanding what's going on, when it happens, and what that blast radius is going to be the most effective way to limit the overall impact.
You know, I just want to, you know, reinforce that, like, the whole paper is worth reading, folks. Obviously, we can't dive into it in super depth here, but it's an interesting read. So I encourage our listeners to go check it out for themselves. But we do have to move on to our next story for today. These are cloud attack trends for 2026. In a new article by X-Force strategic threat analyst Omari Jones, with contributions from Mohit Goyal, Sophie Cunningham, Jeff Kuo, Erblin Marina, and Austin Zeisel, who's been on the show before, Jones digs into the latest trends in cloud attacks. The highlight is that threat actors are targeting cloud ecosystems, not cloud infrastructure. Here's a nice quote from the piece that I think sums it up well. Threat actors have shifted away from attacking hardened endpoints and are instead looking to exploit the core of modern open source ecosystems. As identities, integrations, APIs, workflows, and administrative tools become more interconnected, attacking the cloud's edges has become more efficient and often more scalable than breaching its core services. Kimmy, I want to throw to you first here. I want to ask you for your thoughts on attackers kind of targeting the cloud's edges. What is it about this arrangement that makes them so attractive a target for hackers right now? Any thoughts there?
Once you get in, your opportunities to laterally move are wide open, right? That doesn't mean that you're going to find the perfect place to pivot to the first time you land on, you know, the beach. But the fact is, once you hit that cloud edge and you're into the environment, then you can move around and do other things. And that's what attackers are taking advantage of.
Absolutely. And it gets to, you know, this sense that, like, I feel like we are once again seeing some fundamental security 101 flaws, in the sense that, like, the integrations are the space where we're seeing trouble here, right? Like, they're not properly bounded. They're not properly segmented. Maybe it's identity and access management stuff again. And Seth, I the last time you were on the show, we were talking about this notion of, like, we keep coming back to these security 101 flaws that we can't seem to quite get right. Any, you know, look, I know I asked about you last time, but I'm going to ask you about it again. Any thoughts here on, like, what is it that makes this stuff so pernicious for us? Any thoughts there?
I think when it comes to the cloud environment overall, is that a lot of the ecosystem and its convenience, and really one of the drivers that you have in adopting it, is the implicit trust that is there, right? I can federate this service. I can reuse a lot of different components that make it worth my while and easier to spin up new elements, right? So that implicit trust leads to a very fertile breeding ground for the attackers to say, hey, if these tokens or these applications or these APIs are the only things that are allowed to talk, I'm going to focus on that heavily, right? Because I would always rather have a fake ID than try to just sneak in, right? So it's going to be good. I have a successful authentication. I go in. So as you look at the way these work, hey, you're using an Entra ID. Well, that's linked to your Active Directory. Now, there is no, you know, in the way that we think of an old school network, we're not linked directly to the cloud, right? That's in a completely different enclave. It's connected via the internet. But if I can get through your authentication back, well, now this entire service that is really expanded throughout your organization can become compromised. And so it starts to be looking at going back to, okay, should we have one account to rule them all, so to speak, right? Is that something that we want to continue to do? It's easy, right? Very rarely do good security and great usability line up. It's a trade-off that we have to go with how usable and convenient something is and how secure it is, right? The most secure computer in the world is one that is connected to nothing and does nothing. And that's sort of the thing we have to trade off with, right? Is as we adopt these cloud services, we have to think of, well, how much convenience is too much? And are we relying on too much of these services as critical infrastructure in a cloud sense when we necessarily they weren't designed that way?
Oh, I was just going to spin off of the cloud services opportunity. You know, we expect the main provider to do a lot of the security for us, AWS, IBM, whatever, Azure. Yes, that's great. We do expect. But third-party services within that cloud environment are another opportunity to infiltrate or exfiltrate, if you will, right? So again, it's just looking at where are those access points and how do you secure them. But I feel like a big part of it is zero trust, right? It's defense in depth, lots of layers of security. Every place that you have to log in, you need MFA on that login, right? All those kinds of things. But it's a big question. It's a big problem because, like I said, once you're in the environment, you just got to look for the next pivot point. Where can I go next? Can I get into the Active Directory? That'd be great. Now I know where all the admin credentials are. Cool. Let's go after those admin boxes, you know?
And I think that's actually one of the problems. Like, we're building these bigger and bigger, more disparate systems. We're making them hybrid. We're connecting different clouds, different identity providers. And if any of the different trust or security assumptions are not directly aligned, then that is a potential hole and a potential gap. And if you don't understand how all of these different ecosystems are supposed to come together, if you don't understand all the roles and responsibilities, who's supposed to do what, and if they did actually, in fact, do that, it's very difficult to then prove things all up and down the stack and across the entire ecosystem. All of that is just going to lead to more and more places where people can get in.
Absolutely. Every kind of connection is a potential weak point, right? And even, and again, I'm going to quote something that somebody has said on the show before, you know, Jeff Kroom, right, said, my component can be completely secure and your component can be completely secure, but when they connect, that gap can be all it takes to cause a problem there, right? And so, you know, look, like Seth said, the only perfectly secure computer is one that does nothing and nobody uses. So we can't do that, obviously. So, but the question does arise then, okay, what can we do, right? And one of the things that kind of comes to mind here from this article is this idea of shifting the mindset from viewing cloud security as an infrastructure problem to an ecosystem problem, right? And I want to ask you folks here, what does that actually mean in practice to adopt that kind of mindset shift to see it as an ecosystem problem rather than an infrastructure problem? Ian, any thoughts on your end there? I'll ask you first.
It probably has to do with, you know, looking at this as, you know, that shared responsibility, like who is in charge of the different components? What are you actually supposed to be doing? Are you relying on kind of the next layer down? And it's not just something that is entirely kind of baked in.
No, that makes a lot of sense to me. Seth, how about you? Any takes there on your end?
Yeah, I think ecosystem implies something that inherently has to have items that are out of our control, right? In the physical ecosystem, it's things like weather, climate trends. We have to deal with these regardless. In the cloud ecosystem type of conversation, it's I've chosen to accept that I'm using XYZ for federation. I'm using this for ID. I'm using OAuth for all of this. And that those components are inherently out of my control. So I have to come at them with a completely different risk disposition, right? When I look at something in infrastructure, traditionally on-prem, I purchase every server, I purchase every cable. I have complete control over everything that's running in my data center. As soon as I step out into the larger ecosystem view, it's about taking a mindset of understanding and accepting that there are certain services, some of which I will depend upon greatly, that I will not control. And so from a supply chain perspective, it's starting to accept that I could have risk introduced or a flaw introduced into my system by no fault of my own, right? And so building your defenses and architecting your networks in a way that accepts that, hey, at some point, this tentpole sort of item may go down. What happens next? Because we have to accept that it's not within our control is probably the best way to start to shift the mindset.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. And I like that you kind of highlight that, like, you know, this might sound silly, but like ecosystem, it is ultimately a metaphor, right? In the sense that like it gestures towards the fact that there are things that are outside of our control. And like, I do think that's a key component of this. And it's one that I frankly had not been thinking of as I mulled this over. So I'm glad you brought that up. Kimmy, any final thoughts on your end in terms of, you know, what it means to treat this as an ecosystem problem? Any last words?
I think these guys did a good job of summing it up, really. It's the overall problem. It's the bigger environment problem. It's not something that you have control over directly. It is not your sandbox anymore. You're sharing it with everyone else. And now you have to figure out, what does that mean? And what is acceptable risk for my environment?
That gives me a nice segue into our next one, which is, here's some stuff about your sandbox being used by people who shouldn't use it. I am talking about ransomware attackers living off the land. Over at Dark Reading, Alexander Kalafi synthesized some new reports from Google Threat Intelligence Group and Coveware to arrive at the conclusion that ransomware attackers are increasingly ditching external tools like Mimikatz and Cobalt Strike. Instead, they're using the built-in tools of compromised systems, so think, you know, PowerShell, Windows Utilities, stuff like that, to maintain persistence, conduct recon, and exfiltrate data. Now, Kulafi ties this move in part to a less lucrative ransomware market. Payment frequency and amounts are down thanks to improved detection and disaster recovery. So he believes we're kind of seeing external tooling fade and people are kind of making do almost. Seth, I want to throw to you first. Initial thoughts, especially around why we might be seeing a bigger pivot towards living off the land with ransomware attackers right now. Is it just a decrease in payment? Is there more at work? What are you thinking here?
Well, certainly the decrease in payment drives it, right? If there's less money at stake, that's going to change the tactics and especially the tooling. Hey, if I can be more efficient. You got to remember, ransomware gangs and even any sort of criminal enterprise operates just like us in the business world. We have to turn a profit at some point. And so if there's a lower cost way to do things, as the craft, I guess, of ransomware would sort of improve over time, they would find efficiencies. But what I really think it is just the maturity in EDR products and other detection technology that have driven attackers back to native tools, right? Because these executables, these native tools are not going to be immediately highly alerted on the way that more common exploits are, right? In terms of signature, there is potentially a completely legitimate reason that this PowerShell session completely just opened up, right? Even something, I believe the article mentioned, some extremely high percentage of RDP still continuing to be used internal to environments. Well, RDP, if that was out of the internet, obviously a huge security flaw, but the reality is a lot of internal administration is happening that way. And so there's no quick and easy telemetry way to tell a clean, you know, normal help desk supported RDP session and an attacker-driven RDP session sort of offhand. We have to dive a lot deeper to that. So I think the advancement of being able to tag a lot of the external tools very quickly as malicious has driven folks sort of underground back into the usual flow of traffic. It's like anything else. If you look like you're supposed to be there, it's going to be a lot easier to kind of be there, hiding in plain sight type mentality.
And you know, it's interesting to me because, you know, you point out that, like, okay, ransomware payments are down. We're getting better detecting some of this stuff. It's forcing them back to living off the land. I'm wondering, and Ian, I'll ask you this. I'm wondering, do you think this says anything bigger about where ransomware is going in the long term? Or do you think, look, this is just a temporary development. We'll see what happens next. I guess my question is, should we not draw too many conclusions from this? What's your thoughts here?
Probably really difficult to draw conclusions from this, you know, directly, or at least in terms of like where it's going to go. As Seth said, it's really where the money is. I think one clear reason to kind of go to the tools already there is, you know, they're already on there. Like, you don't have to compromise the machine. When it comes to like the payments, though, I'm kind of curious to see if these, you know, different detections, and the article also mentioned a little bit of, you know, fewer organizations actually paying out the ransom, and that actually kind of decreasing the cost. But that actually kind of opens up the question, what about the double and triple ransom? So are you now going to go and, you know, release the data or go after the customers who the data is about? And so it's actually going to open up, you know, different potential markets because, again, the attackers are always going to kind of go and pivot to wherever the money is.
That's a very good point. These guys can be endlessly creative with what they do, right? And so just because, you know, organizations might be paying the ransoms less, it's like you said, maybe they'll shift targets a little bit, go after the people the data is about. It's worth thinking about that. And that brings me to another question, which, Kimmy, I want to throw to you, which is, you know, how does this shift in towards like kind of living off the land a little bit more, how does it complicate our lives as defenders? Any thoughts there?
Yeah, it complicates our lives quite greatly, thank you very much. Because as we've all just said, it looks like normal traffic. You're using PS exec to go do some administrative activity, or maybe not. Maybe you're an attacker and you're using PS exec to laterally move to another device. It looks the same either way, right? This is the challenge. I think that, you know, the fact that fewer organizations are paying and that they're paying the big numbers is a lot of the reason for these guys to pivot back, like you said, to go into the living off the land. Also, it's easy. It's easier. It exists already. But it also lends itself to multiple opportunities of extortion. I've stolen your data. Now what are you going to do about it? How badly do you want this data? If you're not going to pay me, then I'm going to go and bother your customers that I have their data, and I'm going to tell them that I have your data from them, right? Can I get them to pay me? I'm going to look at all the opportunities, right? I don't think ransomware is going away, but we may not see as many encryption events, right? But we will probably continue to see exfiltration. We'll continue to see stolen data appearing on the web. Lots of credentials being stolen all the time, right? Don't need ransomware when you can just stroll in the front door and, you know, wipe a bunch of devices because you feel like it.
I'm actually kind of glad to see living off the land attacks back. I mean, it kind of brings me back to high school when I used to use Norton Disk Doctor to disable foolproof in the school's computers. But I'm kind of going to be like where the future is going, just kind of tying back to the earlier story. Like once you start having all the ransomware campaigns, which are just living off the land tools, it's really, really easy now to have an AI agent that it can automatically go and make the tool calls and call bash and, you know, execute things in code mode. And so it could just be that, you know, there'll be a bit of a lull, but all of a sudden these things will kick back up a notch and you'll just have, you know, AI accelerated ransomware because again, they now have the craft built entirely off whatever is already there and they don't have to bring it themselves.
It's like you were reading my mind because I wanted to ask, you know, where the AI fit in here? And the reason I wanted to ask that was because, you know, we've been talking this whole conversation about how like they're living off the land again, they're going back to the old tactics. And that seems to like run up against some of these narratives about, hey, we're generating all this AI-powered malware. But Ian, I think you synthesized it really nicely, right? Which is that, like, if you're living off the land, you just set up an agent to do that stuff for you, right? Like, that is a very, I can see that coming to pass. I don't like it, but I can see it coming to pass. And Seth, I want to, you know, before we close out this segment, I want to ask you any thoughts on your end in terms of the so what here, right? We looked at this, we surveyed where everything is going in ransomware, or at least where it is right now. What's it mean for us as defenders? Is there anything, any practical tips for us to take away and use here?
Well, I think it sort of continues to reiterate something that we've seen a lot of information on, especially on the incident response and pen testing side, is that the Active Directory, a lot of the internal stuff is maybe a lot harder to configure, to lock down, to get it secure, and still more attractive for the attacker. Sure, there's a lot of great focus on external application vulnerabilities, and I believe that was the number one vector in our threat intelligence report that just came out. However, once you get in, that GUI center, so to speak, is all Windows flaws that are, one, well-documented. So to Ian's point, an LLM is going to have a field day being able to use these tools because they are 100% documented, known output, exactly what's going to happen. So having to try to take a real hard look at what traffic is expected from what machines and starting to implement that and lock that down. And I think the challenge is a lot of that comes down to us as cybersecurity and IT professionals taking away and making things harder for ourselves so that that can't be used against us.
Doesn't it seem like we always make it harder to come in the front door, but the windows and back doors are always wide open? I'm like,
exactly. It's sort of like, well, yeah, everyone will authenticate through this path. However, wink, wink, those who know can still get in back here.
And well, the bad guys just come in the back door.
Exactly.
I've had Threat Intelligence Index on the brain for the past few weeks, and just reminds me of that stat that came out of it that like 56% of the flaws analyzed didn't even need authentication to exploit them. So it's just like you said, Kimmy, it's like we can strengthen that front door all we want, but that's not where they're coming in necessarily anyway, you know? To move us along, though, here's another kind of story about sort of the old times coming back to us. I'm talking about cybersecurity's rusting edge. This is also another piece from Dark Reading. They had some good stuff last week. What can I say, folks? But in this op-ed, ESET advisor Chuck Everett argues that the real front line of cybersecurity is not the cutting-edge AI-driven tech we're always talking about, but, quote, the OT and PLCs running on Windows 95 or custom DOS kernels that power much of our critical infrastructure. Everett calls this the rusting edge, which I really like. I want to steal that from him. But quote, the dirty secret of critical infrastructure and American manufacturing isn't that we are behind on patching. It's that we are running the backbone of our economy on systems where patching is physically impossible. Kimmy, I want to get your thoughts first here on do you think we've let the kind of AI and quantum stuff, kind of run away with the spotlight, and we might need to really reorient our focus a little bit more here? How do you feel about that?
I mean, definitely AI is a big player right now, and it's going to play in this field just as much as the others. But yes, we should be looking at our OT and ICS environments, and we should be looking at making sure that they're patched, making sure that they're kept up to date, making sure that if you can air gap it, you do. If you can't, then you have hardened administration on it, right? And none of these default passwords and other things that we fall back on sometimes to make things easier on us. but again, you bring up this, the tougher problem of the hardware itself is difficult to upgrade, if you will. And, I don't know. I don't know how to answer that problem other than to, keep it top of mind and try to build in security as we go along and to consider these systems as things that need to be considered. Because up to this point, there's been a lot of, it's fine. We don't need to worry about those. Nobody wants that. Yeah, everybody wants that now.
Yeah, and I think that that's actually a really good point. A story we did last week on Mark Rusinovich, the CTO at Microsoft Azure, ran a 40-year-old code through Claude, and it like immediately found all these vulnerabilities and stuff in there. And it's like, you can see something like these ancient pieces of technology that we've kind of ignored and we not really thought too much about, or a lot of us have not thought about them. People like Everett definitely think about them a lot. But you can think nobody's looking for vulnerabilities there. It's become a lot easier to look for vulnerabilities there now, right? Like, because you don't have to be a person who knows. And it is a tough question in terms of like, what do you do about it? I'm not saying we have the answers here, but I am unfairly going to ask you folks, and Ian, I'll unfairly ask you first. What are your thoughts here in general about this model, about what we can do about it? Just give me your take here.
I think the first thing is, it doesn't really surprise me at all. I mean, I think we've been doing this across all of our critical infrastructure, whether or not it's IT or not. I mean, roads, bridges, buildings kind of collapsing because it's not exciting. Like, no one really wants to pay for the maintenance from the upkeep of any of these things. They want to kind of build the new and kind of move on.
I think
Exactly. And a lot of it's, well, it's not going to be my problem because I'm going to be gone. I'm going to be retired. I'm going to take my paycheck and that's kind of the end of it. The thing I'm going to wonder is, do we need the equivalent of a right to repair for critical infrastructure? Like when I build a nuclear power plant, like I have to actually be able to fix this thing in 20 or 30 years? Or is the problem that we are taking things with like a 20-year time span and trying to stretch them to 30, 40, 50 years?
That's the question, right? Like is the issue that we're trying to stretch these things? Or like you said, I like this idea of like a right to repair almost, right? Because it brings me to another part of this piece from Everett, which was what he describes as the eBay supply chain, which is, organizations literally hunting through like eBay and bankruptcy auctions to find pieces to keep things running. Seth, you look at this situation. I just want to get your kind of take on, the rusting edge, the eBay supply chain, everything that's come up so far. How do you think we confront a situation like this? What do you think we do?
Yeah, I think it's a difficult situation because, as has been kind of alluded to, it's effectively a huge capital expenditure problem, right? We would all agree as tech professionals, we look at this technology and say, it still works, but it's extremely aged. I would upgrade it if. I would do this if. And because it works, and typically utilities, when talking about critical infrastructure, are part of some kind of public trust, right? You can't undertake hundreds of millions, billion dollars to upgrade all this infrastructure to simply improve the back-end tech stack and then pass that on to the customer. That would be sort of outrage, right? And then on the other hand, how are we supposed to justify, I'm reliable enough as is, I'm investing this for increased reliability. It's a lot about sort of the insurance conversation, right? How much do you have to pay to prevent a bad thing that might never come to fruition, right? So trying to unlock that becomes some of the first difficulties. How do we view this? The current situation does work. We're at a huge risk, right? If you have critical pieces that you are trying to source from eBay, which is, hey, it might be good, it could be not even authentic or genuine of what you're purchasing. You have to do a lot more due diligence on that. But really, it comes down to a problem that has been kind of swept aside. As long as everything's running and the lights are literally on, no one's going to ask those questions. But it really becomes chicken and the egg. Who invests to stop this proactively before something bad happens?
We're running out of time here, folks, so I have to move us to our final story, because I don't want to miss the opportunity to discuss this. Someone finally hacked the Xbox One. Now, the reason this is a big deal is because Microsoft head of OS security, David Weston, once called this thing the most secure product the company ever made. And nobody had previously hacked it since its introduction in 2013 until now. In a talk at Reverse 2026, hacker Marcus Gezadelin recounted how he successfully broke into the console, getting around its nearly airtight security controls by manipulating the voltage to the hardware. I'm not even going to pretend I fully understand exactly what he did to do this. All I know is that he did like two extremely carefully timed voltage zaps that got him past all these fancy guards, and he had, you know, what he called a god level amount of control over the system after that. It's a funny story, you know, that's part of why I'm bringing it up, but I'm also bringing it up because I'm wondering, is there anything we can take away from it, or is it just a kind of curiosity, an interesting thing that happened? And Seth, I'll start with you first. You look at the story of the Xbox One finally getting hacked. Anything we should take away from it as cybersecurity pros?
Yeah, so I think as you kind of described, the technical hack of it is sort of really, really deep, right? It's super cool. Even I read it, I'm like, there are multiple oscilloscopes involved here. This is probably, this is a 500 level type of hack. But I think practically speaking, what's important is the preservation aspect of this, right? This will later allow us to emulate Xbox One and other similar systems and help us to potentially get around this. And, you know, there isn't a lot of profit instead of that. Who needs to emulate an Xbox One game? And I think it doesn't necessarily mean anything now. I mean, there was a time when I was in high school that we figured out how to get NES emulators to network with each other so we could play Tecmo Bowl across a computer lab, right? Those ROMs didn't matter at all then, but lo and behold, 20, 30 years later, you see Nintendo reselling these, reusing that digital content. And so from a games preservation perspective, I think long term, us having this better understanding of how the system worked can help us keep that sort of as stewards of the history of, you know, this sort of now 40 plus 50 year old hobby, right?
The Xbox was like this unhackable thing, but we just got finished talking about all of the kind of holes in our OT security that we rely on. And it did make me wonder, like, you know, I don't know, can we apply similar levels of protection to these things, or is it just less feasible when it comes to it might just be more feasible with the console. I don't know. I'm just thinking out loud here. But it was curious to me that, like, this thing was so much harder to hack than these devices that our critical infrastructure relies on, you know? But I also like, you know, Seth, this archival angle that you took there, that's really interesting to me, this idea of like there's a kind of, you know, our ability to hold on to some of this stuff because, you know, the systems that we build, the software, can become quite ephemeral and there's value to keeping it around, right? Ian, thoughts on your end in terms of, I don't know, anything we can take away from this as cybersecurity pros?
Probably a couple of things. I mean, you know, again, thinking back, you know, it used to be a whole lot easier. So, you know, you'd burn a CD, you'd pop it in, it would have a little boot disk, and, you know, you could do that for Dreamcast, Phantasy Star Online. Used to download unsigned images and everything. And to see what actually went into doing this for the Xbox, you know, how many Xboxes did he actually completely destroy doing it? You know, the multiple, like, it actually is quite a testament to how much the hardware has actually gotten better. You know, applying it to the last story, I think there's a very different threat model in terms of, like, I have this hardware, it's in the adversary's hands, they have a financial incentive in theory to kind of, you know, create, a pirate market, that type of thing. Whereas in critical infrastructure, you know, typically it's secure. I think the article even joked about being like, you know, embedded 20 feet in concrete, typically with ribbon wire fences and men with guards. So I think there's very, very different kind of threat models when something is actually put out there in the field, you can actually get access to it versus something that is in theory in a secure facility.
I mean, that makes a lot of sense too, right? These are fundamentally different things serving different purposes. And so it might not be fair to do kind of one-to-one them. So I like that you bring that up as well. Kimmy, you started to kind of answer the question already, but I want to throw to you more, you know, explicitly, you know, what kind of takeaways do you think there are for us as security pros from the fact that this 13-year-old system finally got hacked? Anything there?
I would look at how did we keep from hacking it for those 13 years. what made that Xbox so secure that it required a hardware hack, an actual zap of electricity to make it, you know, give up its secrets, so to speak, eventually? That's the one aspect. How do we emulate that for current technology? The other aspect, though, is at least we know that your average hacker is not going to sneak into your data center and, you know, with all his multiple oscilloscopes and and do multiple electrical pulses on your hardware to try to get in. But they have other ways.
No, this is very true. I think it's unlikely that anyone's going to see this kind of thing replicated on their systems. But it is, you know, to me, I think it's just like a neat illustration of like the perseverance of the hacker. And I don't even necessarily mean like a cyber criminal. I mean like a good old fashioned hacker like Marcus Gazdelin, who is just like, I want to crack this thing because no one's done it before. I want to be the one who does it. And that can lead to all kinds of wonderful things, but it can also lead to all kinds of problems for us as well. On that note, though, I do have to end our episode for the week, folks. Thank you so much to our panelists, Kimmy and Seth and Ian. Thank you to the viewers and the listeners. Please subscribe to Security Intelligence wherever podcasts are found. Stay safe out there. And I guess you have to hide your Xbox Ones now.